begin to introduce you to Steve Gumer. And so he's going to come up and share with us. So what would be really fantastic is if you all would give Steve a very warm Walker Harbor welcome. Thanks, Steve.
I would like to start by introducing the coolest intern ever. This is Anders Rotschafer. Would you stand, please? Give him a hand. His project for the last 5 months has been to make me hip, and he has failed. But everywhere we go, we get new young girl followers, so I count it a success. So stay tuned to Anders Rotschafer. I'd like to also introduce Jen Tendero. Jen is our operations director in the U.S. Would you stand, please? Jen and Anders will be at the table in the back after our talk here, and they're selling books, and all the books go to support the families and the children that I'll be talking about today. My wife and daughter just wrote this book. It's for children. It's a read aloud ABCs of Myanmar book. If you want to introduce your kids to the story that you'll be hearing today in a gentle way, this is a great book to get. And my wife wrote this, and my wife wrote this, and some other guy wrote this. So these are all for sale, and if you can't afford them, just give the word or say just take the book because they're free. We also have magazines in the back. I hope you'll take one. They're free. And I feel really grateful to be here. This is the last, or actually second to the last Harbor Church that I will have shared with, and I have found a ton of common ground with these congregations and pastors. In fact, we've been invited to office out of Fairhaven, and generous, wonderful leaders who really care first and foremost about people and engaging with people, and not the sort of moralistic things you need to do in order to be one of us. They don't have that attitude. And I find myself responding, wanting some of that love. Do you too? It's a really special thing. And I'm grateful to be a part of it. In 1994, I hiked into Shoglo Refugee Camp with my wife. We were both church planters. We started a couple of churches. My wife started one in Japan, and then we started one together in Thailand. We were working on another one, and we were leading a Youth Without Any Money training base. That's YWAM. Have you guys heard of that organization before? So we were working with this young organization trying to make the gospel real, and we were relatively successful in our work, and had decided it's what we want to do for the rest of our lives. So in 1994, when we hiked into this refugee camp, it wasn't really, it was just an adventure, and we wanted to find out what refugees look like. In a way, it was sort of a visit to Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Lost, whatever, where he's got his whip and his cowboy hat. I thought I was that guy. Like, I could save the world with a whip. And we went into that camp, and when I walked into the camp, I was blown away because I'd never understood or seen firsthand what being a refugee is like, what malnourishment looks like, what stepping on a landmine does to your face if you survive and the leg that you've stepped on it with, what it means to have your village burned down and run for your life and have your hygienic process all destroyed and messed up, what parasites look like. All of these things I never had been engaging with. I'd never met them firsthand. And when I did engage with these things and understood the story of suffering that these people had been through and a war that I didn't even know about, which is incidentally the longest running war on our planet, that's Myanmar, I was kind of unraveled. I didn't know what to do with it. It didn't match my theology, being there and wanting to be good news didn't match my theology. A large body of these suffering people were Christians, and for their faith and their all-night prayer vigils, their wife got raped, their daughter got dismembered, and they stepped on a landmine while they were running for their lives. It was a kind of confrontation with everything I had built as kind of the boundaries of my faith. And so I wanted to explore not just the story of these people, because I did want that, but really the story of my own hypocrisy. If our faith won't work in a refugee camp, it's not really worth believing in. If it won't work where the poorest of the poor are to be found, where suffering is at its visceral worst, it's not good news. If it's not good news for them, it's not good news for anybody. And that was my starting point when I decided to reread the Bible. Now, right when I was starting to reread the Bible, on about our third visit to this camp of 9,000 souls, we walked into the home of a woman who we had become friends with. Her name was Rose. And on the floor of her bamboo hut that was built to last for one or two rainy seasons, you know, 2 years at the outer limit, and she had lived in this hut for 8, 9, 10 years. Sleeping on the floor of this hut was a beautiful little girl who had been freshly bathed in the river next to the hut. The river really was a trickling stream, and it was the source of water for these 9,000 people. It was the source of bathing. It was where all waste was dumped. It was where water was taken to boil so that they could cook their rice. It was everything. This little girl had been bathed. They rubbed coconut oil into her hair and parted it. She was stunningly beautiful. About 4 years old, but they don't actually know how old she was, because where she was taken from, there's no paper, there's no hospital, there's no wheels, there's no fuel, there's no cars, there's no machines. Just a man and a water buffalo and a hand-built yoke to drag his plow through the soil and over thousands of years bring more and more water deeper into the valley so that he could grow more rice and feed his family and his growing family. Well, we asked Rose, what's the story with the little girl? And Rose said that the pro-democracy soldiers, the Karen National Union, sent a unit of soldiers to that village where she was from to find survivors and document what happened for the human rights record. When they got there, they found the village completely destroyed, bodies everywhere, and by some act of God, they found one surviving human being. And that was this beautiful four-year-old little girl. They said that the little girl was probably being carried by her loved ones while they ran from the village as it was attacked. And while they were running, knowing that they would be caught, decided that they would hide their daughter or their niece or whoever the loved one was. They decided to hide her in this hiding place. Continued running, hoping to distract the attention of the advancing Burma Army soldiers. And a few days later, these pro-democracy soldiers found this little girl, and they picked her up and carried her for 3 days to the Moy River, which is the natural border between Thailand and Burma at that point. They crossed the Moy River, went down the Shoklo stream, where these refugees, numbering 9,000, had been given permission to settle and refuge. And they took this little girl to Rose. The reason they took the girl to Rose is because Rose was known as the one who was there for anybody. If you were breaking down, Rose would show up. If you weren't able to get your children to school, she'd knock on your door and actually pick your child up and take her to a day program that she started for traumatized children and for families who, because of trauma, were not able to get their kids into school. When we met her, Rose had, I think she had 30 kids in school. She was well known as a woman who started, she actually started a library, she called it, but they didn't have any books. But it was a library where victims of sexual violence would meet periodically and talk to each other to restore the dignity of community. She was really well known in this refugee camp, spoke fluent English with a British accent, and her story alone is worth a Sunday meeting. But she told us the story of this little girl and how the soldiers carried her across the river and then to Rose's house, and they asked Rose if she'd be the foster parent for this vulnerable life. And Rose, of course, said, yeah, pick me, I'll take her. And she took in this little girl, and a few days later, my wife and I showed up in Shoglo refugee camp. And is this mic working okay? I realized I just tapped it and it sounded different. Is it okay? Okay. So Rose told us this story and looked up into our eyes and said, would you tell your friends in the West, would you help me? And I said, of course, what can we do? And she said, well, help me support this little girl so we can get on our feet and help me start a safety net for kids like this. And so remember I mentioned the agency we were working for, YWAM? That's Youth Without Any Money. And so I asked Rose, what's the cost? We, at the time, my wife and I were living on $500 a month, and that was to support our ministry and our life. And so Rose and I sat down and made a list, flip-flops, a change of clothes, school supplies, school fees, a coin for the offering plate. Rose was a wonderful Christian woman. And having calculated everything, blankets, towels, everything this child needed, including supplementary food, in the interim period that it takes for that child to get on the feeding roster of the camp, the total cost was $30 for a year, everything she needed. And so remember I said that rereading the Bible was a way of confronting my inner hypocrisy? That really confronted me, because here is a wonderful, vulnerable life looking me in the eyes and saying, are you there for me? And my wife and I simply said, yes. Now, what happens when you say yes to an adventure like that? Whether you're in a refugee camp in Thailand or in a war zone in Syria or anywhere in the world, including Grand Rapids, Michigan or Walker, Michigan. What happens when you say yes to that kind of a request? It turns out that there's another something equally challenging and threatening right around the corner. And within a year of saying yes to that first little girl, the word got out that there was a safe place for children, and there were over 30 kids in Rose's home by the end of that year. When she passed away 9 years ago, Rose had 87 of these kids in her home. These are kids that watched their parents get executed and all of the most terrible things and violence that you can imagine. They were not just witnesses, but they were involved in that. And then they were brought to this woman, Rose, and Rose was this irresistible force of love. You know, she was an Anglican, and infant baptism actually means something different to Rose than it means to y'all here. And I was very suspicious when I met her about some of her unorthodox theology. You know why? Because I knew everything. How many of you know everything? And, you know, I kept track, too. I kept track of the 37 children I led to the Lord that previous summer. I kept track of how many times I read the Bible. It was up to 7 at that point, cover to cover, 7 times. I kept track of course, all the verses I memorized, including the first 3 chapters of Romans. I kept track of how often I fasted and how long. One time I fasted for 7 days, liquid fast, and I was pretty sure God liked me more than every single person in this room. And I was pretty sure I would be kind of like supernaturally engaged with by God, Old Testament style, you know, chariot taking me off in my physical body to hang out with Moses. And I met this little girl, and we said yes to this little girl, and there was this confrontation, this dissonance between our experience and what we understood was the gospel. The gospel to me at the time was a contract that you put your signature on. It was a collection of propositional truths that you ascended to in your mind, confessed with your mouth, and then you were in the club. And the problem was that with that is that how many of you are in the same club you were in when you started this adventure? I mean, could it be said that you have been being saved every day of your Christian experience? That is, in fact, how one of the verses that Paul uses parses out, that we are being saved? Could it be that we are constantly learning what it is and wrestling with what it means to belong to God and His family? And how do we, I mean, who made us the judge? Our job, what is our job? You know, Billy Graham says this, my job is to love. Not to figure out who's in and out. Not to figure out who's dirty and nice. My job is to love without discrimination, without boundaries, boundless love. I am called to be the most loving creature on God's planet. And I get that straight from the Bible. I get it from JC himself, who said that the white hot core of faith is this: you will love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you'll love your neighbor as yourself. That is, in fact, the message of the entire Old Testament. It's the summary of the Ten Commandments. It's the summary of the Levitical Code, Leviticus 19:18. That's where Jesus gets it. And that's what's echoed through all the epistles. And somehow, having read the Bible so many times, I turned it into something else. I turned it into all about me being more spiritual than you, being closer to God than anyone who has ever lived. But what was that tree producing? Go ahead and bookmark Matthew 23, because that was me. I was a poster child for that. When Jesus talked to the Pharisees, what did he say? He said, you sons of the devil, what makes you think you'll escape the flames of hell? You're whitewashed and beautiful, like a tomb on the outside, and inside you're filled with maggots and decay. That was me. You strain the gnat and swallow the camel. That was me. I had all theological paradigms figured out. I read Sproul, Stott, Ryle. I read Packer. I even read the old guys, Octavius. I read Presbyterian Reformed. I got all heavy and read all of the old mystics, John of the Cross, Brother Andrew. Man, I had this thing nailed. And what happened? I met a little girl. So it snowballed from there, and my wife and I, everything got out of control, and every time we went to the camp, there were more children. And what did we say? We said, we can't afford this, but we love you, and we love those children. And this is our emerging understanding of the gospel, that it is not just words. It is my wallet. It is my time. It is my car. It was my motorcycle back then. It's everything I am and possess. And that is what it means, I believe, to belong to God, to love Him first with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, to belong to Him and to love our neighbor as we would love ourselves, or as John says, to love our neighbor even as Christ loves them. So, rereading the Bible, I came to this super extremely annoying passage, and it became the cornerstone verse for my faith and for partners. So, if you'd skip ahead 3 slides, please. I think it's 3 slides. The slide where there's 1 John 3:17-18. That's right. 1 John 3:16 says this. We know love because Jesus loved us and laid His life down for us, and that's what we ought to do for each other. That's verse 16. Verse 17 says, when you see someone who is materially destitute, who is poor, and we close our heart and do not engage, how can we say love is in us? Have you read that verse before? You know, I don't care what side of the aisle you stand on politically, you're going to have to deal with that verse. And verse 18 is like the let us not love with our words or tongue, but with actions and in truth or deed. I read that and I was like, how did I miss that, man? I read the Bible 7 times cover to cover. How did I miss James 1:27? You know, the brother of Jesus who says, true religion, true spirituality is loving and helping widows and orphans in their time of distress and keeping oneself clean. How did I miss that? How did I miss Matthew 25 where Jesus says, you know, I know you because you visited me in prison. I know you because you gave me food to eat when I was hungry. I know you because you cared for me. How did I miss it? I really don't know. I have an amazing ability to miss important stuff, apparently. And as I read this and as I asked myself, how does Rose and these refugees fit into the story of my faith? My faith started getting very malleable. And I started caring less about whether or not people checked off my boxes to be within my set. And life got really interesting at that point. If you go to the next slide, these little girls I met a few months ago in Syria, and they survived an attack by ISIS fighters that took their family from them. Their mother and father were killed right in front of them. Their grandmother was shot in the nose and in the hip and fell over, and they thought she was dead, but she wasn't. She was in that, just to the side of that picture. One of those little girls lost her finger when an ISIS fighter cut it off, and one of them, an ISIS fighter, tried to cut her leg off. Now she's got a permanent disability because of that. I asked myself when I met these girls in Kobani, Western Syria, what does the gospel look like? How do I embody this? How do I make these kids understand that they're loved by God? How can I help them understand that trauma isn't the starting and ending point of their lives? I drove from Kobani with my host to the city of Manbij, which is just outside of Aleppo. It's the last Kurdish-controlled city in Syria before Aleppo and Homs. And in Manbij, we went to visit a guy who was a pharmacist who, before the war went crazy, started taking in physically and mentally handicapped children into his home because they were on the street. And his notion of faith, he was a Muslim, his notion of faith was that these children had to be cared for. They can't just end up on the street because their parents are dead or uncaring. And so he started collecting these kids from all over the city. And they called him Papa. He's a pharmacist. He didn't have to do this. He could just be rich and comfortable. But he felt, this is my call. This is what I do. And I went to visit him and met his children. And they were very just beautiful kids. And one little boy came up to me. He was about 6 years old, and he had just come to the home, and he had a big scar on his head. And I asked why this fresh, it wasn't a scar, it was a wound. Why does he have a big gash on his head? This little boy came and grabbed my camera as soon as I walked in and started taking pictures of all the other kids. And he was a total clown. And the guy said that he and his older brother, who was also in the home, were brought to him a few days prior to us getting there, a week prior to us getting there. And some of the children asked him, where are you from? And the little boy said, I'm from Raqqa. My dad's an ISIS fighter. And the kids, these mentally handicapped kids and so forth, beat him up. One of them picked up a brick and smashed him in the head. And It turns out the little boy's dad was defending a position, and he ran away. And as far as they knew, he was dead. And his mother had a breakdown, and she ran away and joined the other hundreds of thousands of innocent families trying to survive in the Nineveh desert, where nothing grows and there's no water. And this little boy and his brother were wandering in the streets trying to survive in the city of Monbich, and someone found them, and they knew about this pharmacist who took anybody in. And they took these two boys to him, and now they live with him. You know why the kids beat him up? When ISIS attacked Monbich, it's a city of over 1 million people. When they attacked this city, they were advancing to where the pharmacist's home was, where he lived with his eight, foster children. And as they were advancing, the pharmacist realized that their lives and his were at risk if they stayed. So they piled into a pickup truck and drove across town. And they drove through one neighborhood where there were snipers crossfiring into the road that they were driving on. So everybody hit the deck. His kids were in the back of the truck. One of the little girls who was mentally handicapped was sitting on the back of the truck, and she wasn't very smart. And she didn't bend down, and she got shot off the truck. 9-year-old girl. And they couldn't go back and pick her up for 5 days and bury her because of ISIS. And there was a picture of her with flowers all over it that the children had made as a memorial. And in Islam, if you don't have a dad, you can't get married. I think this girl was 9. And she had just had a talk with the pharmacist and asked if, because he's her father, that he would help her get married. The pharmacist cried like a baby when he told me the story. And so I asked myself again, what does it mean to be good news? What does it look like? How does Jesus get involved in a story like this? If a tree is known by its fruit, that pharmacist is pretty dang close to Jesus. Just like a millimeter away. How do I interact with him and be good news? What words do I choose so that he understands I'm here to be part of his story of discovery, and he mine? So we invested in that home. My team did. Partners Relief and Development is what our name is. We chose it because we realized that being an underfunded missionary couple, we're going to need lots of partners. And so we named ourselves Partners. And Relief and Development is our go-to programs. We want to be there for children who, because of violence and conflict and complex politics, are not getting food. Can you think of any places like that in the world right now? Do you see the international news? You know what's happening in Yemen? 8 million people starving to death because of a proxy war that's being fought by Saudi Arabia and Iran, siding with the so-called rebels and the so-called government. And guess who suffers? People like us. And what does it mean to be good news in Yemen? What does it mean when we see or hear this news? What is our response? How do we answer that need? You want an answer? I have one for you. There isn't one. Because we are as unique and amazing and intricate as God Himself. And the way that He interacts with us is not prescriptive. It is always unique. And all of us are in a place of working our way to understand what it means to follow this guy. What does it mean to live as Jesus lived? 1 John 2, verse 6. Can you skip ahead? Those who say they live in God should live their lives as Jesus did. In fact, that's what proves we're not liars when we say we follow Christ. That's the previous verse. We follow Christ and stuff should happen. That stuff may include reaching out to Yemen or reaching out to Myanmar or other places of extreme need. It may include those wonderful people at Bethany who help Rohingya incoming refugees to Grand Rapids, keeping them off the street. It may include engaging with the issue of our time, second only to slavery, human trafficking. And this is one of the arteries of it, right here. It may include just the strength to love our physical neighbor. I'm not here to share a head trip or pretend that I have answers, because God is doing that with you. And I'm not here to give you a guilt trip saying, shame on you for not caring about the war I work in. The point of us being here is to celebrate the life that we're drawn to, that irresistible, magnetic life, Jesus. And we're here to figure out what it means to follow Him. We're here to figure out what it means to somehow reach into the deepest inner part of ourselves and walk like Jesus walked, to live like He lived. We are the embodiment of good news, and everything that belongs to you doesn't. Everything we think we possess really is in the hands of God. He gave us life to begin with, and empowers us to live now. What does it mean to walk as Jesus did? Now, I've often heard, I forgot to start my stopwatch. What time does the service get over? It's 11, 10 after 11 right now. Okay, well, I will not hold you more than 5 more minutes. One of the things I often hear when I'm visiting churches afterwards, people come up to me and say, we can't do what you do. We can't live into the space that you've just described for us, and we feel guilty about it. And I have two answers for that one. I want to give them to you, even if you're not asking the question. The first answer is, the night I gave my life to Christ, I burned 3/4 of a sheet of 4-way window pane, LSD. When I was going to finish selling that sheet of acid, I was moving to Boulder, Colorado, because my goal in life was to smoke copious amounts of marijuana, stay high on anything within my reach, ski every day possible when there's good snow, and read good books. That was my goal in life. I dropped out of high school when I was a sophomore. I moved out of my home when I was 15. I'm not like the guy you would have chosen to run an aid organization or a Christian mission organization. And the point is, if I can do something, anyone can. If I could do what we're doing, any of us can. Absolutely any of us. I grew up in a trailer, abused by my mother and stepfather, neglected. I had everything going against me. And my story is that accepting that God is a part of this equation, I don't have to say no when it appears to be God inviting me. That impulse of love that draws you to Him, if what is stopping you is a sense of unworthiness or I couldn't do this, well, think again, because that's not coming from love. It's not coming from the same source that is inviting you into an adventure. Our team, our little team, helped 419,000 refugees and displaced people this year. And I got to be a part of that. And I got to be a part of it because I said yes. So when you have this child looking up into your face, when you have this challenge staring at you and inviting you and playing with your head, I encourage you to make it a yes. And I believe that around the corner of that yes is adventure to come. And the adventure includes more transformation and more amazingness than you can imagine. I'd like to show you one slide. This is one more slide. This is just from, I took it out. So what'll it be? Like, what do we do? There is no guru. I know that. Wally doesn't have the answer. Nobody does. You read the Bible, that's a living document, remember? We can live a life as Jesus lived. We can find the posts, but what are the limits of our love? At what point do we say we've reached it? I don't have an answer for that, and I don't bet you do either. But if you say yes and you engage, I promise adventure, and I promise something very deeply satisfying and joyful. If your adventure somehow connects with ours, please come to the table. I'd love for you all to grab one of these and give me your address, because then we can invite you into our adventure. I'm pretty confident that you'll find things worth praying for if you get our magazine and our emails. And any other way that you might participate, maybe some of you would like to join our motley band of people trying to figure out what this all means. We need you. More importantly, the world needs you because you are Jesus. You are the incarnation. You are what people are going to meet. You're the closest thing this side of heaven that will ever be again. You are a one-off original. There will never be another Cam again. Cameron, you're it. So my encouragement to you is love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself, and watch a fire grow when you do that simple thing. Thank you, and God bless you.
Steve, I would love to pray for you, and then we'll invite the band up, and we'll close with a song so that we can just kind of spend a little bit of time reflecting, absorbing that as best we can. But I'd love to just kind of take a moment and pray for Steve, his team, and us. Father God, you are good. You are good, you are good, you are good. And your goodness calls to that which is deepest within us. We are created in your image. Every single person in this world is created in your image. And God, I pray that each of us here will have open hearts and open ears to hear your voice, calling us to you, to love you with everything that we are, and to love our neighbor. God, we bless you for Steve, his team, God, and everything that they are doing and how they are listening, obeying, and doing everything in their power to walk in your footsteps. to be your body in the world. God, may that inspire us, challenge us, call us to do the same. Even if it's to the mailbox and back, in the gas station, in the schools, in our workplaces, and wherever you call us and invite us. God, as Steve said, may we say yes. God, keep whispering, keep talking, keep shouting, keep singing, that we would hear you and say yes. Yes. We bless you and we pray this in the name of Christ Jesus. Amen.
Thanks, Willie.